the trial of Derek Chauvin, I think, is a good place to start in the murder of George Floyd, which is happening right now in America. And this is the killing which obviously sparked the latest round of inspiring Black Lives Matter protests, which had people everywhere questioning the role of the police. You know, for the first time in a long, long time, basically since the 60s and 70s, the question of abolishing or defunding the police was put into the popular imaginary. And I wanted to share this. Is that going to work? So this is one of the court pieces of court evidence. These are a bunch of the people, the witnesses who witnessed the death, the murder of George Floyd. And I just think it's a good place to start because it tells you there's something very sick about our society. These people had to watch, and they all, you know, in their witness statements talk about how powerless they felt. They had to watch a man be murdered in broad daylight. They filmed it. They screamed about it. They shouted. They tried to stop it, but there was nothing they could do. They just watched a man be killed in 9 minutes by police officers. And there's, I think, something really sick about a society in which there is a force like that, a police who are a supreme power on the street, who can do whatever they want, and including murdering people in cold blood and get away with it. They almost never suffer a single consequence for it. You know, it remains to be seen if maybe the Black Lives Matter movement and the huge protests will force Chauvin to be properly found guilty of murder, but that is an extreme rarity. Most of the time they get away with it. So I want to talk about the kind of fucked up society that needs police and what purpose they really serve. And in this talk, we're going to have to constantly debunk all of the liberal, like, mythology that we get told about the police, which is just shoved down our throats in, you know, TV shows and movies about cops, in school when you learn about constable care or whatever the equivalent is here. That's what it was in Perth. You know, law and order campaigns by politicians and stuff. We're soaked in a pro-police rhetoric all the time. So a lot of this talk is devoted to debunking that. But it's in the liberalism stream, and I will be talking, I think the key way that most people understand the police is in a liberal way. So I wanted to talk about what liberalism is to start us off, and also because this is the first session in the liberalism versus Marxism stream. So I think liberalism is the fundamental ideology that underlies the capitalist system. According to liberalism, society is just an ocean of atomized individuals with their own unique interests, all competing and jostling against each other as buyers and sellers on an impersonal market. And for liberals, to keep this, you know, competitive mass of people who just tear each other's throats out, to keep them, controlled, it's necessary to look to a higher power, a neutral arbiter, to police, human interests in general, and to intervene, in disputes. And so for liberals, the police are a really indispensable institution. The police are meant to be neutral, apolitical enforcers of just laws. They're the people who keep the peace, they stop and prevent crimes, and they mete out justice. The other key liberal myth that underlies the police is that we're all equal before the law. And so the police, at least ideally, will treat everybody the same, rich or poor, black or white. We know that's not true, but that's the liberal idea. Now, more left-wing kind of liberals can be critical of the existing police, but the criticisms are always at surface level, that the police have deviated from the kind of ideal that they're meant to represent, which is why I think a lot of the time, critiques of the police have centred on corruption. And, like, just think about the word corruption. It's a rot in an otherwise healthy thing. Something's just gone wrong with this otherwise perfectly fine, natural body. There's also, the critique that police are just not following the rule of law, that if they just kept to the laws and followed them, that they would be better. There's the bad apple argument, the idea that they just have too much racial bias and we need to train them out of it, and so on. So the liberal mythology of a police force which upholds just laws is, and that we live in a fundamentally free and equal society, couldn't be further from the truth. The police have never played nor intended to play this role. So I wanted to start by debunking some of the myths. Firstly, they don't solve crimes. Every single piece of fiction about the cops basically portrays them as big, crime solvers. From Inspector Morse to Law and Order, SVU, whatever you want, like, detective work, piecing together these exciting puzzles and mysteries seems to be at the heart of police work, but nothing could be further from the truth. They don't solve crimes. They're most likely to charge someone if someone has actually witnessed the crime, if the police themselves have witnessed the crime, which rarely happens, or if the victim just directly knows who the accused is. So there's not all this kind of exciting crime solving going on. They don't keep the peace either, which is another huge myth about them. If you get murdered by a stranger in the US, there's a 1 in 3 chance that you got murdered by the police. So actually, really, they do the opposite of keep the peace. They are murderers. And they also don't obviously there can be brawls and fights in society or whatever. They do not de-escalate these, or stop them from happening. Most of the time they escalate them, actually. So in 1988, a chief constable, in the UK in London said that most disturbances, quote, begin with a minor incident that escalates once the police arrive at the scene. This is like a chief constable saying this. He says, there are times when we are slow to respond and it doesn't become such a serious incident. Stop responding there. The police are far more likely to commit domestic violence and sexual assault than to stop it. They're also way more likely to commit sexual assault and domestic violence than the rest of the population. An office, and they also do this on the job. This isn't just feeding their wives at home, which I'm sure they do, but it's also actually on the job. An officer is accused of sexual misconduct while on duty every 5 days in the US. They don't protect ordinary people's property either, especially, working class people. They're not there to, solve your burglaries and if your car gets jacked or whatever. The majority of home burglaries are never solved, and the majority also committed against the poorest people, often by poorer people. And the police are actually allowed to steal goods. In fact, they're the biggest thieves in the whole of America, according to recent stats that came out. There's a thing called civil asset forfeiture, which happens basically everywhere. It's essentially a revenue-raising exercise that's even worse and more insidious than just, the speed cameras on every corner. The US, the police can basically just, if you're deemed to have, have some property because you committed a crime, they can just take it off you. And actually that accounts for more theft than all the other thefts in the US combined. To give you a sense of it, the Victorian government in Australia stole $45 million in 3 years from just ordinary people. Another myth is that we're all equal before the law. Now, I think this is important to go over because the police, do a lot of things, but there's some things that they never do. They do not police, for example, and patrol wealthy suburbs. They don't, go onto the yachts in Sydney Harbour or whatever and, shake people down for using cocaine. They don't go around arresting business people for embezzlement or tax evasion. Police don't step in to arrest employers who break employment law or provide unsafe workplaces, even when that results in deaths, which happens all the time. And it's important for the capitalist class to have, rules of engagement for business so they don't screw each other over too much. And these are codified in law, so they have those laws. But that is how most crimes that are done by the capitalist class are dealt with, through corporate law. It's not even seen in the same way that crime is. So the whole categorization of the legal system into, business of corporate law on the one hand and criminal law on the other reflects the class antagonism in society. Wage theft is dealt with in industrial courts, not in criminal courts. So even if you're, like Coles was recently found guilty of stealing, I think it was $20 million consciously from their employees, you're not going to go to jail for that or even get sacked. You might just have to pay it back and pay a bit of a fine. Whereas obviously if an ordinary person went and robbed a bank and somehow, Ocean's 11 style, stole $20 million, there would be massive repercussions. They would go to jail. So there is literally one law for them and another for us. And the police exist purely for us. They don't care about corporate law. They don't care about enforcing that at all. So the other thing is they don't really enforce laws. That's the other argument, that they're there to, there's all these just laws and the police just go around and see people breaking them and enforce them. And this is really not true. A top cop in the US said recently, if you know the law well enough, you can make it do wonderful and marvellous things. It's a creepy way of saying that basically the law is a tool in the hands of the police that they use to do another function, which I will talk about, but they don't actually enforce the laws. In fact, they regularly and deliberately break the law themselves. Surveys of officers have shown that most of them believe that their job would literally be impossible if they had to act legally all the time and if they weren't allowed to break the law. So for the most part, police work is actually intensely boring, and to the extent they do anything at all, it's, you know, anything useful rather, it's things that not any ordinary person could do, like get a cat out of a tree or finding a lost kid at a supermarket. But the thing they spend the majority of their time doing is, you know, walking around, harassing poor people, and that kind of thing. And it's why I think they're, you know, such trigger-happy lunatics looking for thrills, and why the kinds of things that we've seen across the US and also here in Australia against Aboriginal people happen so frequently. So I wanted to talk about what the police are actually for, what they actually do. Whoops, that was about liberalism. Here we go, liberal myths about police. So the thing that they actually do is police the entire working class, not by policing every member of it at every moment, but by criminalising the poorest and most marginalised sections of the population. And this is why they're, you know, notoriously racist. I'll get into more of that as well. It's not because they're not educated. It's because structural racism means that the often the poorest and most marginalised sections of the population are black, brown, LGBTI and so on. They also police all moments of the class struggle from its smallest to largest manifestations. They police protests and strikes, but they also spy on and harass groups deemed a threat to society. So socialists, anarchists, animal rights people even, Muslims and so on. And lastly, in the last instance, they're a bulwark against mass rebellion and revolution. And we're seeing that right now in Hong Kong. We did see it in Hong Kong. We're seeing it right now in Myanmar as well. So fundamentally what the police do is keep order, and that's really important. And they're keeping a particular kind of order, which is the capitalist order, a system based on mass exploitation of the working class and production for profit. So obviously this is meant to go over the history, so I want to talk about basically how that happened, how the police were created. And I think the police were created for a specific purpose. Firstly, to create the working class itself and to actually help create capitalism, which is kind of a way we don't normally think about it or talk about it. But I like this quote from a police theorist, a Marxist, who says that the transformation of the immediate producers into wage labourers, into workers, took the form of a massive police operation. So that's a great quote. I'm going to try and expand on that a bit. And then secondly, throughout history, the police have continued to play this role of policing the working class in the interests of capital. And I'll quote again from the same guy who's called Mark Neocleus. He said, "Police is necessary because capital, as the modern master, is forever at risk of losing control of the class of which it is master." So we're going to talk about those two elements. Okay. Well, the police is a capitalist invention. Every class society, though, including ones before capitalism, need some kind of repressive apparatus. But these usually resembled, you know, in centuries ago, things like the Night's Watch, which was the form that it took in England and across the rest, a lot of Europe, which was a pretty unserious force. It was kind of like doing jury duty, basically. Like, you did it part-time, you weren't paid, or you were paid very little. No one really wanted to do it, and you were kind of seen as, like, a bit of a jerk as well if you, because you, you know, have to live with your neighbours and whatever, and they think you're, like, spying on them and whatever. The other form that it took was bounty hunters and thief catchers, and then obviously rebellions were put down by in-class societies, but usually by armies. So you'd go and fight wars, but then the army would have to come back and put down some kind of rebellion. The police are obviously quite different to all of those things. The police are a permanent, professional, armed wing of the state, which goes, it's like a domestic army. It goes among the people, it patrols them in their cities, in their suburbs, in their workplaces. It can knock down their doors and police them in their homes. And they can, obviously they're capable of murder and very serious brutality, but they're not mainly trained to kill people. They're armed with non-lethal weapons to repress without, constantly provoking further rebellion. You think, like, how hard it would be to keep our society in check if every time there was a protest, like, a bunch of people got murdered, you would face even further rebellion on your hands. So why does capitalism need the police? Well, the working class is much more powerful, numerous, and concentrated than previous oppressed classes. They can stop production merely by downing tools together, and their rebellions are more regular and massive. So you can't just rely on that external army to come and crush the occasional rebellion. Working class people need constant surveillance, according to the capitalists, and punishment to deter them from such uprisings. The other thing is that the relative freedom and anonymity provided by large cities meant that the exploiters, you know, like the capitalists, couldn't any longer just have like a immediate, directly control the exploited. So instead of having a slave-master relationship or, you know, a master and an apprentice or whatever, you have like huge numbers of working class people now being controlled by a single capitalist or, you know, in a single industry and stuff. So it requires a lot more policing. And you had thousands of workers shoved into factories and cities and mines, and thousands more unemployed and living in desperate poverty as well. So there was a serious need, according to the capitalist class in the 1800s, to have greater control of the population. So this started in the late 1700s. Liberalism had become by this stage a way of not, you know, really about liberty so much, but a way of justifying the new system. And liberal philosophers became a lot more interested in profitably running capitalism than in overthrowing monarchs. So you have the emergence of like utilitarianism among liberals like Jeremy Bentham, who was obsessed with making the perfect Orwellian prison, or Edwin Chadwick and Patrick Cahoon, who both campaigned for, these are all in England, who campaigned for professional police forces and the internment of destitute people in workhouses. I'll see, I've forgotten about my, there we go. So Cahoon is one guy I wanted to talk about mainly. He was a wealthy Scottish merchant and magistrate, and he outlined the problems that the British bourgeoisie faced. He said the working class had not yet been turned into wage labourers. Really, they hadn't accepted wage labour. They still expected the centuries-old custom of receiving some of the products of their own labour. So coal workers would take lumps of coal, ship carpenters would take timber, dock workers would claim like spilt bags of sugar and coffee and so on, and cloth workers would receive scraps of cloth that they called cabbage. So there was just this sense still that if you were working for a boss, you still had some right to the products of your own labour. But this was totally unacceptable to the new industrialists, who wanted to pay exact, calculable wages to their workers, no more than they had to. And they wanted to account for all of their stock, even spoilt stock. So even like if it's rubbish and you can't use it, they didn't want the poor to just be able to take that home. It means, you know, they're substituting their wages in some ways. It means maybe they don't have to, you know, like accept the wages that you're giving them or whatever. Cahoon wanted this custom payment to be recast as theft, as crime. He calculated that millions of pounds of stock were being stolen from the docks of the Thames in London. And he said that 90% of that theft was being done by people who legitimately worked there, which he was just outraged by, and thought that a police force was necessary to recuperate that. I should say Cahoon was a merchant who had a lot of interest in the River Thames in particular because of the ships that brought coffee and sugar from the slave plantations, and he was an owner of a whole series of those ships from the West Indies. He was also pissed off that the whole of society had not been disciplined to purely accept money currency yet. He complained about the secondary economy of the streets, the street hawker, the street market, the pawn shop, fencers who bought stolen goods and stuff. Oh, sorry. That's Patrick Cahoon who I'm talking about. And so on. People often bartered goods instead of using coins that were legitimate in England. And this, he thought, encouraged theft from industry because it encouraged you to go and try and get, you know, bags of sugar or whatever that you could trade. So basically it was a part of the economy that was out of the direct control of the capitalist class, and they did not like this. They also thought that all of this fun and frivolity of, you know, like going to pubs and ale houses and whatever, that this could allow the poor to, that it would be a distraction for the poor, basically, to distract them from working for the bosses. And that also it could just disrupt legitimate businesses, you know, if you have like hawkers outside a shop, that would be disruptive. He also was very upset that the working class was just generally ill-disciplined, unruly, and prone to riots and rebellion, and that they hadn't psychologically accepted their role as exploited workers. So he proposed a police force, and in 1798 his merchant friends agreed to fund a trial of 3 years. They financed the first professional uniformed police force in England, and it was called the River Thames Police. So it consisted of like 50 well-paid officers armed with truncheons, and they were responsible for paying the exact wages to the workers, supervising the unloading of ships and patting down workers after each shift. So they enforced like an anti-theft dress code. They're like, you know, pocket police, basically. The lumpers, though, which are the dock workers, did not just take this lying down, which gives you a sense of how, you know, the police had not just been accepted as this normal, natural thing. Only a year after the police were set up on the River Thames, 8,000 dock workers and their families had attempted to burn down the police station. And Patrick Cahoon, the guy who invented those police, was actually trapped inside the building at the time. Sadly, they failed and the police regrouped and really smashed the docks. Smashed the dock workers. But this is kind of gives you a sense of the class struggle that was involved in the formation of the first police. It was around this time in the early 1800s that, in England in particular, they started to introduce more and more laws that were designed to make people work, basically. They have all of these this unruly mass of people who've been pushed off their lands, pushed off out of like peasant agriculture, thousands and thousands of people, often unemployed in the cities. And the idea was we need to make them work for the capitalist class. So they introduced the Vagrancy Act, which literally it just meant the police, when they were formed properly in 1829, could go around harassing people for any reason. And interestingly, this is still the law that UK police use to police, you know, harass anyone. Like it says if someone looks suspicious, you can just go up to them and ask for their details and arrest them and so on. So it's actually been found that a lot of the like racial profiling and like, you know, harassment of black people in the UK, they're still using this Vagrancy Act from 1824 to do it. They introduced as well in 1839 broad stop and search powers in London, and they defined as offences activities such as obstruction, sticking bills, writing on walls, using noisy instruments while begging, selling or entertaining. So all of these laws, and there's a plethora of them that start to be introduced in England and all over Europe as well, and then exported to the colonies like Australia and America, they're all about policing the poor in the centre of their universe, on the streets, in the workplaces, in the bustling cities. And this wasn't just an attempt to discipline the working class, but to shape their thinking and morals and instill a proper work ethic in everybody. So along with the police went what we would now kind of refer to as welfare or social security, but its purpose then and now was not to just provide nice things for the poor. It was about exercising social control over them. So the police helped to enforce what were called the new poor laws. They interned the unemployed in workhouses. They, you know, policed the alehouses to try and make sure people weren't having too much fun and being distracted from work. The sexual conduct of the poor came under great scrutiny as well. Gay people began to be imprisoned or sent to asylums. And poor children were either sent to workhouses or new schools, not really because, you know, to get a wonderful education or something, but to instill obedience in them in schools that really mirrored factory life. So all of that went along with it. And the other thing that came along with it was the ideas that we now know as criminology. Liberals formulated a whole... Oh, I'll show you the workhouses. There we go. They all kind of look the same, but, yeah, there's prisons, schools, asylums and stuff in there. So they formulated a whole new set of ideas about crime. Rather than the typical view of seeing the masses as a dangerous, dark mass, they began to cleverly separate the idea of criminality from the good and useful, you know, hardworking poor. In reality, no sharp division existed, and it still doesn't today. Like, obviously, lots of working class people who wouldn't think of themselves as criminals have to, like, do a bit of crime occasionally or whatever, not be perfectly law-abiding in order to survive. And that was obviously the case in the 1800s. But it was a useful idea. The criminal became a bogeyman, someone who violently disrupted good order and who wasn't driven just by poverty and need, supposedly, but because of indigence and you know, just evil intent and an inherent criminal mind. And the criminal elements in the population had to be disciplined publicly, kept away from the rest of the population, interned in prisons and so on. And the study of criminology in this era really began in earnest. And with it obviously came the absolutely perverse phrenology and the race. It wasn't just about race as well, as you can see. There's apparently that's an unreliable mother over there on the right, so watch out for that head shape. But this all really went together. It was about demonising certain sections of the population as the cause of the immorality of the working class as a whole. And the idea was to kind of discipline them massively in order to supposedly make the good ones all, you know, go to work and shut up, basically. Yeah, all right. Well, that brings me to racism, which has always been really important to capitalist policing. Basically, every racially oppressed group that's ever existed has been stereotyped as criminal, they've been over-policed and disproportionately incarcerated. So obviously Black people in the United States, Indigenous people here and in the United States, migrants often, Muslims, but also, you know, in more like in history, Irish people, Catholics, Jews, like anyone who had a sort of racialized, was a racialized minority of some kind, or not even necessarily minority, was policed massively. And I think these two factors are responsible for racist policing. Basically, the criminalization of poverty and the ideas of criminology, which say that, you know, this is because of moral deficiencies in those who commit crimes. And then this becomes a kind of racial stereotype, which applies to, you know, Black people or Indigenous people, that they're just they're more criminal. And I think another thing that is often not really thought about that much is that the ruling class are really terrified of rebellions by the oppressed, basically. And particularly if you oppress people like Black people in the United States, you know, force them into slavery, then they're a really brutally oppressed section of the working class. You're always going to be terrified that they're going to rise up against you and maybe even lead some much more broad rebellion against you. And that's why there's a need to systematically divide Black and white people and to really criminalise and demonise the people who are the most oppressed in society. So, for example, under slavery in the US, slave patrols were introduced explicitly to prevent the growth of an organised coloured community. That's a quote from one of the first slave patrols. And, you know, they did this by constantly monitoring slaves and free Blacks, by weapons inspections, but they also policed any fraternisation between poor whites and Black slaves. And you got to ask why. This is not just because they were implementing their ideas about racial purity. This is very clearly about trying to stop any kind of rebellion by the masses as a whole, but particularly when you could probably imagine that this was always going to be sparked off by a rebellion first of the most oppressed of Black people. And this continued, and obviously, as lots of people have recognised, the slave patrols became the basis of the modern police forces in the South of America. And it you know, happened in the 70s. Like, there was a real terror, I think, struck into the heart of the ruling class in America by the massive rebellions, the Black rights movement, you know, civil rights and Black power in the US. And the answer to that, really, in the late 70s and 80s was the massive criminalisation and demonisation of Black people. It's what, like, and they did this in the most insidious way, like literally going and distributing drugs into, you know, crack cocaine into Black communities and then over-policing it and sending people to prison for it as a way of trying to say, no, this rebellion is not actually about rights or about anti-racism. It's just the, you know, terrible criminality of these Black communities. And most obviously, they also outright murdered Black activists in their beds and so on. So I think that gives you a sense of some of the fear that can result in the over-policing of the oppressed. I wanted to talk about broken windows policing, which happened in the like around this era of the 70s and 80s in response to those mass movements. And it's basically the idea of zero tolerance policing. Some broken windows for you there, really good slide. and it was by two criminologists in 1982 who were friends with the arch neoliberal economist Milton Friedman. So it's really part of the whole neoliberal turn in the 1980s. And they argued that if a broken window is left unfixed in a community, it denotes disorder and will encourage vandals to smash more windows. And they genuinely believed that this was true, but they also, it was a metaphor for, like, if there's any hint of disorder in society, that will lead to more crime. And they speak favourably in the article they wrote called Broken Windows about the good old days when young toughs were roughed up, people were arrested on suspicion or for vagrancy, and prostitutes and petty thieves were routed. Rights were something enjoyed by decent folk. So they're a little bit critical of that, but they're mainly like, this is something we've forgotten. They said the link between auto maintenance and crime prevention, so obvious to earlier generations, had been forgotten. And that's what they wanted to reintroduce, a total zero tolerance approach to crime that really recognised that actually the police's role is not about stopping crime, it's about order. It's about enforcing order on the poorest people. And so I think this is really this more open, brazen form of policing, which I don't think is a massive shift from the previous forms, but it's more a return to, or it's more the kind of really vicious reimposition of police power after the kind of upsets of the 60s and 70s. And that's what's really characterised policing for the last 40 years. And it's what's resulted, you know, that along with all the law and order campaigns has really resulted in mass incarceration of police in the US and Australia and everywhere really that are just absolutely off the hook. And in Australia, and around the world, there's been a lot of the same policies introduced. So in Australia, there's like three strike policies for troublesome youth, which means that people who just do like three very minor crimes can end up going to jail. The enforcement of dry communities in the Northern Territory and stuff like that. So, well, I wanted to go through... I wanted to go through like and debunk a few more of the Liberal... myths about reforming the police, because this is really what has kind of come up in the debates since the Black Lives Matter movement last year. And I think most of the proposals, even the ones that that call themselves abolitionist, pretty much are still about just trying to reform the police and essentially keep them intact. So I've already talked about why the corruption idea is ridiculous. The community policing idea is another one that was raised and was actually very popular with like people like Obama. He did a report that basically suggested that they do community policing, and it's been pretty thoroughly discredited these days. But it's basically like the idea of having a midnight basketball game between at-risk youth and police. And obviously this does nothing to like actually help the situation at all. And the whole purpose of it, as Obama said, was to help community members see police as allies rather than as an occupying force. The problem is it's all about making them see them as allies, not actually stopping them from being an occupying force. So it's always about improving community perceptions. And what it's actually done where it's been implemented is help police even more embed themselves in the lives of black and brown young people. Like you can't fucking escape them because they're just everywhere and you're meant to like not only get harassed by them in the street but also play nice with them, play basketball with them or whatever. So it's allowed for just near constant harassment. The other thing that's often raised is like diversity. There's not enough black police, especially, or like if there are more women police, maybe, or whatever. This has just been proven to be an absolute non-starter. In America, the numbers of police who are black actually is pretty similar to the number of people in the population who are black. It's 12% of officers are black and 13% of the population are black. And the race of individual officers in a whole series of studies makes no difference to their use of force, including their use of force against other black people. Some studies actually showed that black officers are more likely to use force or make arrests against black civilians. And some people, some abolitionists explain this by just saying that the key ideology of the police is white supremacy. And so even the black officers have kind of been bullied into it or accepted it in some way. And I just don't think that this really like actually helps explain it, because the police don't just harangue every black person. Like they don't go and police the rich suburbs where some black people live. And in fact, a lot of studies have shown that if you take away the issue of race from the studies and just show the level of poverty in different areas, that the most poor areas, black or white, are the ones that get policed the most. So really the question is, like, so black people are more likely to be poor and, you know, economically depressed because of their oppression, and that is why, on top of the racism, they are over-policed. So I think class is still really the key factor because, as I said before, the police exist and have always existed to police the working class as a whole and keep them in check. And, you know, like you can see this in a bunch of the incidents that happened recently, like in Baltimore in 2015, the protests against the murder of Freddie Gray, for example, if people remember that, He was killed by 3 black officers and 3 white officers. And this was in a mainly black city with a black mayor, a black police chief and so on. The protests were also condemned by Barack Obama. So any idea that diversity is going to change this situation, I think, has already been tried and failed. I want to go through some of the more left-wing arguments, though, that are made about how we can reform the police. One is about, like, they've just become too militarised. And they've got too many weapons. And obviously we should demand that the police have their weapons taken off them. But I think it's a problem that a lot of police theorists, like Alex Vital, who wrote The End of Policing, which is a very popular book on the left at the moment, see militarisation as the problem and see it as like a real shift in policing. And they often talk about like the rise of militarisation or paramilitary policing. I think this is wrong. Like the police have always been paramilitary and have been seen as such by the ruling class. You know, think of all the like wars they're constantly waging, wars against poverty, wars against drugs, war on crime, war on terror. And I think a much better way of seeing it is that the police have always been engaged in a permanent low-intensity warfare against the working class, which is how Mark Neoclias puts it. And the police have also borrowed much of their terminology from the military as well, like the hierarchical command structure, all of that. They also have always used whatever the newest, latest weapons and gadgets are. So when tear gas was first invented, it was actually first used by the French police against workers in France in World War I. And then it went on to be used to gas people in World War I. Another example of a really bad argument, I think, on the left is Bernie Sanders' thing more recently, which I think hopefully discredited him a bit because it was really outrageous, where he said that the police should just be paid more and funded more. So the opposite of defund, give them more money as though they're just like other workers who, you know, just other public servants who are just finding it really hard to do their jobs or whatever. And I think one good argument against this is the police unions. The police basically everywhere are the most unionized, best organized, most successful unions as well, I think, in the world, particularly in America. They're so strong. In 100 large cities in America, a study found the introduction of collective bargaining, something we would otherwise think was a great thing, for police, was strongly and positively correlated with police violence against the community. So what they were using their collective bargaining rights for was not like getting better conditions for themselves and their fellow workmates, but to allow them to get away with murder more often. So this gives you a sense of what the role of the police is, cannot be separated from the fact that they are, you know, they earn a wage and so on. One example, which is really horrendous, in Florida in 2019, sheriffs got collective bargaining rights and it led to a 40% increase in violent misconduct. So it's literally just like letting them off the hook. Letting them off the leash rather. And I think it's important to ask why police unions are so successful. It's not because they have like better class struggle methods than the rest of the workers' movement or something. It's because the state and the ruling class obviously love police a lot more than they love like a train driver's union or whatever. Like they would often give exemptions to police unions. So, for example, in 2014, Scott Walker's union busting law in Wisconsin just totally exempted police, but it was about denying collective bargaining rights to the rest of the public servants. So they're not just another part of the workers' movement. Giving them more money, making their conditions nicer is not going to change what they are. It actually makes them better at fucking us over. One other argument is that we just need more social workers. This is probably the most common refrain you hear on the left, and most abolitionists, people who say they're for the abolition of the police, really say, like, let's just replace them with social workers. So a friend who's in the room actually sent this to me, but hang on. Yeah, I think this gives you a sense, like, police abolition work is not about snapping our fingers and instantly defunding every department in the world. Like, it is, actually, to me. Rather, we're talking about a gradual process of strategically reallocating resources, funding, blah, blah, blah. So this, I think, is really the dominant way that people see police abolition. And it's why I went over in some detail the stuff about the fact that the police and social work, or social security, as it's often called, have always gone hand in hand. They are both about disciplining and exerting social control over the masses of people, stopping people from rising up, stopping people from getting too pissed off, stopping people from, just doing whatever they want, forcing people to work, all of that kind of stuff. And you still see it today. Like the work for the Dole schemes are often like, you know, actually have links to the police as well. All of the Centrelink services and stuff, you know, the police are just a call away for them. The Department of Child Protection Services and stuff can also just like knock down your door and get the police to take kids away and all that kind of stuff. So I think we need to see these, and the neoliberal era as well, which, you know, the last 40 years or whatever, has actually, it hasn't seen the just the expansion of the police, which is often how people think about it. It's seen the expansion of both the police and social work in tandem, and all of these things are about exerting control over the masses of people. Got a lot on that. And like another argument that that Alex Vital, which is the guy who wrote The End of Policing, makes, is that we must constantly reevaluate what the police are asked to do and what impact policing has on the lives of the police. So it's really just about changing the role of the police, reevaluating them, you know, designating a new role. I think we really want to see police abolition as we mean it. Like, we actually think the police do not need to exist. They only exist because capitalism needs to police the poor, because it's ruling over a disgusting class society. And often there's a disturbing part of the mythology that Alex Vital and other police abolitionists buy into, that the police themselves are, quote, sick and tired of being part of a system of mass criminalisation and punishment. There is no evidence of this whatsoever. On the contrary, police violence is only escalating. The police run Blue Lives Matter campaigns in opposition to Black Lives Matter, and they're actually increasingly active in fascist and far-right organisations. So I think the key thing is that none of the social problems of poverty, of exploitation or whatever can just be solved with social workers, and neither do they need to be solved with police. Basically, any kind of police abolitionism which isn't about the working class overthrowing capitalism, I think, will only reproduce the same conditions and system with a ruling class that actually needs policing. So that's what I'm for, actual police abolition. I haven't had time in this talk, obviously, to go over what that would look like, and I really encourage people to go to sessions about revolutions, workers' revolutions, because when working class people take over control of society, they actually regularly have to go up against the police, you know, stand up to them, often in an armed way, and disband them. The revolutions that have gone the furthest in people exerting control over their own lives have always had to fight and disband the police and replace, not even replace the police, but just, you know, like exert control over their own lives and over society in a democratic way, not with the use of a special armed, uniformed, organised police force that is separate from the masses of people. So I'll leave it there. There's probably heaps more to discuss that I didn't get to go over, but yeah.
All right.